watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. On March 6th, members of Rochester's New York Declaration of Peace, in collaboration with 45 other local organizations, hosted a town hall featuring a panel of speakers. Scott Ritter, former UN Chief Weapons Inspector and Marine Corps Intelligence Officer, Elizabeth de la Vega, a former federal prosecutor, and Brian Kassler of Iraq Vets Against the War. The event was part of a broader campaign of action by Declaration of Peace to call local members of Congress to account on the illegality of the Iraq invasion and occupation. This week, I'm going to play you the event pretty much in its entirety. The participants spoke frankly, and I heard a few things I hadn't heard before that contradict the protestations of several congressional members. Though the event's declared purpose was an examination of the legality of the Iraq invasion, it was, in my view, an historical document of mainstream Americans who set out to use the supposed mechanisms of their democracy to find instead lies and hypocrisy. We begin with the Declaration of Peace organizer, Kathy Castagna, explaining the context of the event.
My name is Kathy Castagna, and I'm a part of the Declaration of Peace Affinity Group. On the eve of the fifth anniversary of the Iraq War, we are called on to create a rebirth of civil responsibility. Tonight's meeting is meant to do just that. The Rochester Declaration of Peace Affinity Group welcomes you here as partners in this journey and thanks you for your dedication, hard work, and your caring. Tonight's meeting is actually part of a campaign that our group started last year to pressure our legislators to end the Iraq invasion. After some very successful legislative office occupations by our group, we decided to mount a new campaign that would focus on constitutional law and draw on the support of Rochester's organized anti-war community and our newly formed Iraq Vets Against the War chapter, IVAW. At that time, one of our members, T.J. Buonimo, was the Iraq Vets Against the War chapter president, and he was strategizing with us ways to call attention to the upcoming Winter Soldier event in Washington, D.C. TJ also played a key role in studying with us the legal issues and the laws that were violated by the invasion and occupation of Iraq. So our group put together a position paper, and then we visited all of the congressional representatives in our area, asking for their position on the illegality question. On TJ's recommendation, a planned news conference became this town hall meeting. We then called on all our fellow activists in the anti-war groups, civic organizations, labor unions, religious institutions, and human service programs to join us in making this event possible. This strategic planning has led us to tonight, with two national speakers on the issues of legality. 45 co-sponsoring organizations, many of whom gave us the financial backing to do this, and an IVAW representative who will share the consequences of the Iraq War for soldiers and also help us to understand Winter Soldier that is coming up in D.C. It is clear to us that the time is right for an event like this that can trigger the community dialogue that will ultimately hold our leaders accountable. It seems to us that the law of the land is important to people. We thought maybe we could get people as fired up about an illegal war as they are about illegal immigrants. So tonight's meeting is a well-thought-out tactic as part of a larger campaign to create a dialogue in Rochester about the illegality of the Iraq War and to challenge our leaders to defend their positions. We hope to galvanize our community to stand up in defense of our Constitution and against all illegal and immoral wars. Perhaps a model for us can be Shalom Keller, whom I met last week at IVAW headquarters in Philadelphia. Shalom is a veteran who completed 2 tours of duty in Iraq. When I asked him why he was against the war, he took out of his pocket a well-worn copy of the Constitution and showed me a statement he had printed inside that read, "I, Shalom Keller, do solemnly swear to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and to bear true faith and allegiance to the same." He shared that by opposing the war, he was upholding the obligation he made when he took his oath as a Marine. He said that we are duty-bound to support and defend our Constitution against all her enemies, wherever they are found, whether in the gritty dust of the Iraq desert or in the hallowed halls of Washington, D.C. Go Shalom. Yeah. So our program this evening begins with 2 speakers addressing legal issues. Scott Ritter talking about the illegal actions that led to the invasion of Iraq, and Elizabeth de la Vega talking about the legal case against our administration. They will be followed by Brian Kassler, who will give the perspective of an Iraqi veteran and share more information about Winter Soldier. These presentations were to be followed by our congressional representatives defending their positions publicly. Since none of them have accepted our invitation, it leads us to wonder about the confidence they have in their positions. So instead, we will share with you what our group has done to engage them in the legality question. Our panel will then respond to the few responses that we do have from our representatives on this issue. Scott Ritter is the author of Target Iran and Waging Peace, and he was one of UN's ESCOM most senior weapons inspector in Iraq, after having served for 8 years as an intelligence officer in the U.S. Marine Corps. As a Marine, he conducted arms inspection in both the Soviet Union and provided analysis of Iraq's missile capacity to General Schwarzkopf in the 1991 Gulf War. Nation Books is the publisher of Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plan for Regime Change and Waging Peace, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. I just completed Waging Peace, and I really encourage you to read it. Seymour Hersh says the most important thing to know about Scott Ritter is that he was right. So, with no further ado, I will give you Scott Ritter.
I don't know how much money my publisher paid Seymour Hersh for that quote, but it was worth every penny. The legality of war, I think that's what we're here to talk about. In particular, we're here to talk about the legality of war, the legality of conflict within the context of the current conflict in Iraq. I'm not a lawyer. Thank goodness we have somebody here tonight who understands the rule of law from a prosecutorial standpoint, will be able to help navigate us through the concept of due process. I'm an intelligence officer. My job was basically to gather information, process the data, and then make assessments on that data. I did this in a number of venues as an active duty officer in support of arms control agreements in the Soviet Union, as somebody who fought in the first Gulf War, serving on General Norman Schwarzkopf's staff, and later as a chief inspector with the United Nations Special Commission in Iraq. When I was brought in to Iraq, we had a serious problem. We were tasked with basically destroying, rendering harmless, and removing Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs. And contrary to maybe some misconceptions that are held today, because when we invaded in 2003, we were told there were going to be significant stockpiles of these weaponry, and of course they weren't found, a lot of people believe that there were never WMD in Iraq. Let me just cleanse that from your mind. There were significant weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Saddam Hussein pursued programs dedicated to the manufacture of chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and long-range ballistic missiles. And one of the problems we faced as inspectors was the fact that Saddam Hussein was supposed to declare the totality of his holdings to the United Nations and open them up for verified disposition by we, the inspectors. And he chose not to do this. Saddam Hussein chose to hide up to 50% of his capability. He refused to acknowledge having a nuclear weapons program. He refused to acknowledge having a biological weapons program. He underdeclared his ballistic missile capabilities by 50%. He did the same with his chemical weapons capabilities. And we were confronted with a problem that we, in order to make the engine of inspections work, you got to have fuel. And the fuel is information. And the one required to give us the fuel to make the inspection engine work was Saddam Hussein. And he was giving us corrupted fuel, tainted fuel. The data he was providing wasn't up to the task. So we needed to gather new information. And that's what I did. If you take a look at my resume, you'll be hard-pressed to find any justification for me being a chemical weapons expert. You sort of have to have a grasp of basic chemistry to do that. I was a Marine, not a chemist. It's the same about biology. I wasn't a biologist. I'm damn sure not a nuclear physicist. And you'd be hard-pressed to say I was a rocket scientist. I was a Marine intelligence officer. In short, I was a spy. My tradecraft involved gathering data in denied areas. I was a master of human intelligence. I was a master of signals intelligence. I was a master of photographic intelligence. That's what I did. And that's why they brought me in as an inspector, to gain access to data the Iraqi government was denying us. One of the first things I did as an inspector was to evaluate what we knew. And what we knew is the Iraqis had submitted a declaration about their ballistic missiles. Now, I just happen to have a little bit of background in that, being a weapons inspector in the Soviet Union. I understood what ballistic missiles were, and my war in the Gulf War was basically to participate in the hunting down and destruction of Saddam's Scud missiles before they were fired against Israel or the Gulf Arab states. So I knew a little bit, but I reviewed the data, and in November of 1991, I wrote an assessment that said, I think the Iraqis are lying. I think they're holding on to about 100 missiles and about a dozen launchers. Under pressure from the inspections in March of 1992, the Iraqis submitted a new declaration that acknowledged this lie. They admitted they were holding on to 98 missiles. Intelligence is imperfect, ladies and gentlemen. I was off by two. And a dozen launchers. So now we have the interesting process of going in and verifying what the Iraqis have now declared. So we send an inspection team in, and I'm leading this team. We go into Iraq, and they take us in buses out to the desert. And I'm thinking there's going to be 98 missiles lined up, and we're going to count them off conveniently. And we get there, and there's nothing. I said, well, where are the missiles? He said, well, we blew them up and we buried them underground. So now we become forensic archaeologists. We bring out the bulldozers and we dig them up out of the ground. But they're not complete missiles. They're bits and pieces of missiles. We have to go through piece by piece by piece by piece, getting the serial numbers off of them. And then we have to take all this page after page of data and go to Russia where they built the missiles to the factory and compare the serial number with the production logs, marrying a serial number to an individual component, then marrying that component to an individual missile, marry that missile to an invoice, shipping it to Iraq. By the end of our work, and this took months, ladies and gentlemen, we could ascertain that we could account for 96 of 98 missiles, and that's pretty darn good work. Now, we didn't know what happened exactly to two. We had bits and pieces over there that we thought were the two unaccounted for missiles, but because the Iraqis had lied to us, we couldn't give them the benefit of the doubt. So he said, there's two missiles unaccounted for. Now, I thought that we had done a pretty good job. So I go to the U.S. intelligence community down in Washington, D.C., in an audience similar in size to this, full of all the intelligence specialists, and I give the briefing. I say, we can close the books on Iraq's ballistic missile problem. We can account for all but two of their missiles, and we have good reason to believe that the two that we can't account for aren't around anymore. Now, you all seen that movie, Top Gun? You know, when Tom Cruise lands on the airplane and everybody's cheering because he shot down all the bad guys? I was expecting the Top Gun moment, you know, because after all, our job was to account for all of Iraq's WMD. I was received by ice-cold silence. Wasn't the message they wanted to hear. A week later, we got a letter from the CIA saying, we reject Ritter's analysis in its totality. We think Ritter's been sucked in by the Iraqis. He's believing them too much. Later on that month, the director of the CIA tested for the United States Senate, saying that there's 200 missiles left in Iraq. 200 missiles left in Iraq. That's curious. We said there were two unaccounted for. Apparently, they're hamsters. And you put two unaccounted for missiles together, and you get 200 before you know it. So I went to the CIA and I said, how'd you get 200? And they said, we can't tell you, it's secret. I said, well, I'm an intelligence officer and I'm the one responsible for this investigation and you're going to have to tell me. You got no choice. And eventually they realized that and they came up with their data. They said, well, it's really top secret, but they hid them. I said, really? Where? And this is where the CIA made a mistake. They said they hid them underground, in mountains, under rivers, under lakes. And they told me exactly where they had buried these missiles. And I said, super. I'm going to call your bluff. We're going to build ground-penetrating radar. And we're going to mount them on helicopters. And we're going to fly them to Iraq in great secrecy and take the Iraqis by surprise. And we're going to go to each one of these sites, surround them, and fly this radar over and find the buried missiles. And I called their bluff. $12.5 million of U.S. taxpayer money later, we had radar mounted on helicopters flying over Iraq. And we went to every single site. We went to the lakes with radar mounted on Zodiac boats. We went to the rivers. We put frogmen in the rivers. They were French. French frogmen. Think of the irony. But the fact is, you can belittle their nationality. Don't belittle their courage or their dedication, because the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, ladies and gentlemen, is muddy. It's like swimming in coffee. You heard the concept of braille diving? As they're down there feeling around because they can't see. We put a radar over. We detect an anomaly. We send it in, but we had to have another radar 100 meters up the river to detect the boulders bouncing down. Because if we didn't detect the boulders and pull the divers up, they'd get hit and they'd be dead. As we were probing the desert in western Iraq for these buried missiles, we had to go inch by inch probing the ground for unexploded ordnance that was littered throughout western Iraq. One mistake, we're dead. It's not a game. It was a deadly serious job, and we did it. How many missiles do you think we found? None. So now I go back to the director of intelligence, Central Intelligence, James Woolsey, and I give him the briefing. We've inspected all your sites. We found nothing, and we reject your 200-missile claim. We go back to our original assessment, which is that we can account for all missiles but two, and we're pretty sure we know what happened to those two. There are no missiles left in Iraq. The director of the CIA said, Ritter, you're a smart kid. Good job. Leave. Called in my boss, and he said, Ritter's right. There's not 200 missiles. There's 12 to 20, and that number will never change, no matter what you do as inspectors. November 1993. Why is this war illegal? Because the United States government knew in November 1993 that there wasn't a Scud missile threat in Iraq. The one honest thing that the director of the CIA said was that there were 12 to 20, and that number would never change. Fast forward to March 2003. We can laugh about this except for the following. We sent American Special Operations Forces, British Special Forces, Australian Special Forces into Western Iraq. They went in the pre-dawn hours. They carried out sweeping raids on sites. Lives were lost on both sides. Brave men died. Brave men were wounded, looking for 12 to 20 missiles that the U.S. government knew did not exist. The United States not only were told that the ballistic missile problem had been resolved, but they knew in 1994 that the chemical weapons problem had been resolved. They knew in 1995 that the nuclear problem had been resolved. They knew in 1996 that the biological weapons problem had been resolved. But it was never about disarmament, ladies and gentlemen. It was about regime change, getting rid of Saddam Hussein and maintaining the perception of a non-compliant Iraq to justify removing the dictator from office. Why is this important? As the prosecutor will tell us, due process has, in theory, been served. The president, in accordance with his requirements under the War Powers Act, did carry out consultation with Congress. And Congress, acting on this consultation, passed a joint resolution authorizing the president to use military force. And on the surface of it, one would say that there's no way you could justify the claim of illegality. However, we must focus on the issue of consultation with Congress. Did the president share the totality of data available to Congress about the true extent of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction? Did the president tell Congress that the 12 to 20 figure that the United States was using in regards to Iraq's Scud missile threat was a fabrication of the intelligence community to sustain not the truth of Iraq's disarmament obligation, but rather to sustain the viability of America's regime change policy? Did the president explain that when we speak of anthrax, that we knew there could be no anthrax because Iraq only produced anthrax in its liquid bulk form, having a shelf life of no more than 3 years, that Iraq never produced anthrax in dry powdered form, so when Colin Powell held up the white vial, Colin Powell knew he was lying. It was misrepresentation. Did the president talk about sarin nerve agent and that what we knew about the Iraqi manufacturing of sarin nerve agent, that it had to be used during time of war because if you didn't use it immediately, within days or weeks, it would lose its viability as an agent, become sludge? Did he explain that to Congress? Or did the president and his agents in his administration willfully mislead Congress? Did they stovepipe intelligence from a known fabricator, Ahmed Chalabi, in a manner which constitutes the fabrication of data? Did the president and his agents commit fraud? And was there a conspiracy to commit fraud? And I do believe that these are questions worthy of an investigation by the United States Congress on this issue. Now, it's curious. We have some names over here. One of them is Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. She seeks the office of the presidency. I'd like to call her as a witness and ask her the briefings she received. She has claimed over and over again that she had no basis upon which to judge the veracity of the president's statements. She is a liar. I briefed her staff personally. I sought to brief her personally on this issue. I call her a liar in the same way I call Senator John Kerry a liar. I briefed him in person. I spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C., briefing senators and representatives on the issue of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program. It was a truth they found inconsistent with their political future. You see, their political future depended on their ability to support the notion of Saddam Hussein as an evil worthy of military intervention. So when we speak of fraud and the conspiracy to commit fraud, one of the roadblocks we're going to stumble upon is the fact that the body we require to carry out this investigation is, in many cases, guilty of the same conspiracy we are accusing the executive branch of being involved in. Is the war in Iraq illegal? I don't want to prejudge due process. But would due process be served by investigating this issue? You're damn right. And the 4,000 Americans who have lost their lives, the 10,000 of Americans who have been wounded, and the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who have perished deserve nothing less. Thank you very much.
That was Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq.
Elizabeth De La Vega is our next speaker. And in her book, United States versus George W. Bush, she asks, what if there were a fraud worse than Enron and no one did anything about it? Just as she did when she was a member of the Organized Crime Strike Force and branch chief of the San Jose U.S. Attorney's Office, Ms. De La Vega spent months meticulously investigating, analyzing, and organizing the evidence. She researched the law and she drafted an indictment. Elizabeth is a former federal prosecutor and brings her 21 years of experience and her passion for justice to the most important case of her career. The defendants are George W. Bush, Richard Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, and Colin Powell. The crime is tricking the nation into war. In legal terms, a conspiracy to defraud the United States. In addition to traveling the country speaking to groups like us, Ms. De La Vega is also a frequent guest on talk shows, and I saw her actually on the Colbert Report. That's the first time I saw her. And I was so impressed by her brilliance in the face of that kind of interview.
Well, the main thing is that Stephen Colbert accurately described me as an activist federal prosecutor, which I thought was very funny. Activist former federal prosecutor. And I'm proud to bear the title, and I'm very honored to be here with this radical-looking group over here, Scott Ritter and Brian Kassler, who, don't they just seem like radical wild men, both of whom who served this country with distinction for many, many years. And I'm also honored to be with all of you, who I understand are activists, healthcare workers, activists, what else do we have here? Poets, all kinds of groups. I think we have 45 groups, and it looks like about 300 people here. And you're out here on a Thursday night when you could be comfortably at home watching Lost. Now, and I think that you and Kathleen, who organized this, and Mary Adams and the other organizers, and Scott and Brian, are all here for the same reason that I am here, which is that we have great reverence for the system of government that we are supposed to have in this country. We have great reverence for the United States Constitution, and we miss it. We haven't seen it in action for many, many years. And I worked for 21 years as an assistant United States attorney, as a federal prosecutor. And my goal in that position was to uphold the Constitution and to, and we took an oath, actually. All federal prosecutors take an oath to uphold the Constitution, just as the president does. But one of the things I noticed when I was working was that the president, in July of 2002, was standing in front of one of those banners he has, which tells you what you're supposed to get from his speech in case you can't figure it out. And it was corporate responsibility. And this was July 2002, and he was signing what was known as the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And he was saying, thenceforth, or he said something along the lines of, from here on in, the people who are in charge of corporations have to tell the truth. Well, this is very interesting to me, having been a prosecutor for all those years and prosecuted fraud cases, because that was actually the law all along. And so even in announcing a new law and purporting to take credit for a new law, the president was defrauding the people about that very law. But what we didn't know at the time, at least most of us didn't, was that as of July 2002, the president, just as he was saying, tricking investors into making investments, and just is a crime, and just as he was saying that all fair risks must be based on honest information, just as he was saying those things about CEOs and their responsibilities, he was at that very time tricking the nation into war and causing the nation and really the world to embark on an invasion of Iraq that was based entirely on the largest fraud imaginable, one against a country 8,000 miles away that had done nothing to us, that had no capability of doing anything to us, and about which we had no evidence whatsoever. So when I took early retirement in 2004, and by that time I was well aware in a general and somewhat of a specific sense that we had been defrauded, but I finally had time at that point to listen to the debate, if you can call it that, on television about whether the president intentionally misled the country. And I honestly couldn't believe my ears, because I would hear things along three general threads. One was, well, the president couldn't intentionally deceive the public because he didn't know anything. And he didn't know anything because he didn't read anything. And that is, in fact, what even critics of the president would say. They would say, well, yeah, he just didn't know anything. Well, believe it or not, and Scott mentioned that he's not a lawyer and that we need a lawyer to understand this. Well, we don't need a lawyer to understand this, because the fact of the matter is the law is almost entirely consistent with common sense. And what the law of fraud says is that if a person is in a position of authority, or if they're portraying themselves as a position of authority, if they're trying to sell you life insurance, for example, or if they're trying to sell you a package for funeral arrangements, or if they're a president trying to sell a war, they have an obligation to find out the basis for what they're saying. They cannot come out and later on say as a defense, golly, I had no earthly idea what I was talking about. That is not what the law requires. And juries are told, and if you've ever been on a jury in a fraud case, you would have been told this, that if a person doesn't bother to look into the basis of what they're saying, that's considered a statement made with reckless disregard for the truth. And that is equivalent to fraud, equal sign. It's another form of fraud. Well, another thing I kept hearing was, well, they believed in their hearts that there were weapons of mass destruction. Well, I'm not sure that's even true, but let's just assume it is for the sake of discussion. Another thing, that's a defense in many, many fraud cases as well. There's something along the lines of the people believe that whatever cockamamie scheme it is that they're trying to get you to go along with will ultimately work out for your benefit. Well, that's another jury instruction that people are told. They're told that it's no defense to say, I believe the ultimate outcome would be beneficial if you lie to people along the way. In other words, you can't lie to people to get them to do what you want just because you think it's going to turn out okay for them. That's another form of fraud. Another thing that they would say is, well, we relied on other people. You know, we just were saying what other people told us to say. Well, that too is a defense in most fraud cases, including the Enron case. Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling said, well, we just did what our underlings, we just were saying things our underlings told us to say. Well, the jury was told, as they properly are, that that's not a defense. If you're in charge, you're required to know what's going on. And when the jurors were interviewed afterwards, they said, well, we're happy that that's the law, because one of them was a principal at a school, and he said, if a kindergarten teacher loses a child, I'm responsible. If something happens to a child, I'm responsible. Everybody in every single line of work, whether they're a bus driver or a CEO, they know that. and the same thing applies to the President of the United States. So I decided, I didn't have a book contract. I had no idea if anybody would ever, if I would even have a book, much less if anybody would ever read it. But I decided I would set about to make this case just the same as I made any other case in my entire career. And my point was not to say that the president and the vice president should be indicted. Although, if you do look at the book, you'll see that there is an indictment. It's hypothetical, but many people find it very therapeutic just to look at. I wasn't talking about impeachment in the book. I don't even talk about impeachment. It was 2006. It was the summer of 2006 when I finished. And my argument was, we need Congress to do its job, its constitutional duty, and oversee and hold accountable the president and the highest executive branch officials for what they're doing. And in the introduction to the book, I talk about an incident many of you know about, but it's really something that motivated me and something actually that motivates me every day almost when I wake up in the morning. The story of Kitty Genovese, and many of you know about her, and she was attacked on the way home from work in the 60s in Queens, and 38 people heard or saw what was going on, and no one called the police, no one did anything, and she was killed. And at the time, it was seen as a sign of urban indifference. Well, there was a study done about that, and it was a little bit more subtle. And what they found was that people thought, first of all, that somebody else would do something about it, which is intuitive, and also that if nobody else was doing anything about it, it couldn't be that bad. It couldn't be that bad. Well, we know this is bad, and it's been a year now, or more than a year, since the book has come out. And when I wrote the book, and on the back cover, I talk about 2,500 American soldiers having been killed. Well, now we're over 4,000. I talk about tens of thousands of Iraqis. Well, the truth is we've never even bothered to keep track, but it's way up there in the millions, most likely by now. And so things have either stayed the same or gotten worse. So I, like Scott, am very disappointed that we don't have any of these people here. I know that Representative Slaughter is considered to be a progressive, and she is. And I was in Binghamton a while ago, and Maurice Hinchey also wasn't there. But I wish they were here. I hope they hear about this, because I worked for the government for a long time, long enough to know how it feels to be in the position where people are calling on you and you're trying to do the right thing and they're saying you're not enough. So I have sympathy with progressive Congress people. But they're the ones who we really need right now. And I wrote to my congressperson, who's Mike Honda, and I asked him, why are we not going forward with impeachment? And I want to address what Scott talked about in a minute. And he wrote back and he said, yes, I believe that the president has committed impeachable offenses. But he said this is how he worded it, the stark undeniable reality is that we cannot get the two-thirds vote in the Senate to convict the president. Now, I want to say right now that that is a misleading response, and it is not the stark, undeniable reality, and it is not even the question, because the impeachment is probably one of the most confusing words we have in the English language right now that people use, but it means a process. It means a trial. So for someone to say we can't have this trial because we don't know what the votes are to convict, that is prejudging the outcome, and it's dodging the question. And the fact is, the only way somebody can take that position and use that as their argument is by denying the reality and by closing their eyes, because the undeniable reality, the provable reality, it's not just undeniable, we can prove it, is that the president has defrauded the country about the war, has defrauded Congress. So, and yes, we need to begin hearings. But in the law, there's a concept called probable cause. And the reason I did this in the framework of an indictment is because that's the test for probable cause. And it means more evidence, enough evidence to warrant a reasonable person to come into a conclusion. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's somewhat less. But it's a substantial amount of proof. We have way more than probable cause that this administration has defrauded Congress about almost every single aspect of this war, both before the invasion started and since that time. You can take any single date, really, in the run-up to the war. September 4th, 2002. The president came out and he had this photo opportunity and he said, I'm telling Congress and the American people we're going to start an open dialogue about this war. And he used that phrase, open dialogue, over and over again in about 7 minutes. And the fact of the matter is that on that very date, as of that date, this is just a little digest of what had already happened, and most of you know this. He had asked for an informal war plan 9 days after 9/11. He requested a formal war plan in November 2001. He had had meeting after meeting after meeting with General Tommy Franks and the War Council. He had come up with a final war plan by September 4th, 2002. He had taken the unit that was in Afghanistan, the most highly trained unit looking for Osama bin Laden, he'd moved them over to Iraq. He had the CIA over in Iraq trying to foment insurgents. He had Vice President Cheney in March had gone to every single country around Iraq. And when Condoleezza Rice was asked about that on the news, she said, well, he just went there because he has a lot of friends. By July, Donald Rumsfeld had authorized to be executed, and they had been executed, more than 50 airstrikes, likely to kill more than 35 Iraqi civilians. We don't know how many were likely to kill fewer because they didn't have to be specifically authorized. And the president, on the very same day, he was standing up talking about the only fair risks are those based on honest information. That was the same day that he authorized, without going to Congress, $700 million of funds from Afghanistan to Iraq war preparations. That was before the open dialogue started. And the open dialogue, you know, we hear so much basically propaganda from this administration that we don't really think about it too much. And you could think, well, it's innocuous. Well, the fact is, Karl Rove and his gang over at the RNC were doing poll after poll about how are they going to get people to agree to this war. And when they did polls about it, they asked, well, what if you think there was not a majority approval for the war as of September 2002. But if they said to people, well, if he goes to Congress, if he goes to the UN, if there's a discussion, would you be willing to support it? Yeah. That was a crucial part of their deception, their plan of deception. Another thing that they asked about, well, if you think it's going to cost such and such an amount of money, what do you think about that? And people were not in favor of the war if they thought it was going to cost any substantial amount of money. So what did they do about that? They suppressed the information. Every time Ari Fleischer in press conferences was asked about, well, how much is this going to cost anyway? He would say things like, well, this is all hypothetical. You know, we have no way of knowing. We can't talk about this. And they said that. They gave that answer right up until the day before the invasion. And it wasn't until September after the invasion that they came up with any numbers whatsoever. And since that time, in the ongoing part of the fraud, they have funded this war with supplemental after supplemental, where we never get the information. People just came out with a book, Stiglitz and Bilmes, where they said that it's impossible to find out how the money has been spent. Huge fraud and double sets of books and all kinds of things. We don't need subpoenas to do these things. And I believe we should have hearings, but the fact of the matter is, we already have the information right now. They can just take the information that's in the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report and analyze it, just the same way I did, the way so many other people have done. They've got it. The day after the open dialogue started, we launched the largest number of airstrikes that we'd launched in Iraq since 1998. It was a very short, open dialogue. We know that when Vice President Cheney was telling us in December 2001 that it was pretty well confirmed that Mohammed Atta had met with the head of Iraqi intelligence in Prague, and that was a key point, you know, making the connection between Iraq and 9/11, it hadn't even been investigated. And I can tell you, as a prosecutor, if I went in with a search warrant affidavit, putting my name to it and my whoever the agent was, and we said it's pretty well confirmed that so-and-so is doing such-and-such, and we hadn't even investigated it, we'd lose our jobs, and we would very likely be prosecuted. That's fraud. And even after it was ultimately investigated and found to be absolutely false because they had records showing they were in Florida, Mohammed Atta was in Florida, he kept saying it anyway. There's example after example. Some are simple, some are complex. The aluminum tubes that you've heard so much about. We know that when they came out and said they were only suited for use in a nuclear centrifuge, they had information, they had at least 14 reports, because they'd known about the tubes because they were buying them on the open market, on the internet. But out of the 14 reports that were U.S. reports, 12 of them said it's in doubt whether you could use these for a centrifuge. Again, if someone's selling a medical product, for example, and they say this is a surefire cure for whatever, psoriasis, and then you find out, well, they have no tests about this whatsoever, what would you call that? Statement with reckless disregard for the truth, at best. But the fact of the matter is, out of the 12 reports, half of them, the ones from our experts, said not only is it in doubt, it's highly unlikely. Why? Because the tubes they were specifically ordering were three times too long, three times too thick. They were made from an inferior metal to what they used before. They were covered with a coating that would have to be taken off. And the clincher is, they were half the diameter. So essentially, you'd have to melt them down and start all over again. And what the expert said was, if they really want to order these, we should just let them have them. Have at it, because they're not going to get anywhere from it. And one of the experts said they were as likely to be able to be used for a nuclear centrifuge as you could turn a Yugo into a Cadillac, if you worked at it hard enough. So all of this is provable, and it's finally provable when Bush came out in front of the country and said, we have to invade Iraq because they're not cooperating with the inspectors. It was absolutely a flat-out lie. So there's no question of mistakes here. And it is not simply that they had a fraud about the war, which is bad enough, of course. The reason they had the fraud, of course, is that they knew that the war was illegal under international law. There was no basis. It was not in self-defense, and we did not have a UN resolution. So like in every criminal scenario, or many of them, one crime begat another. And then they used this war in Iraq, which isn't really a declared war at all, and they used the global war on terror to commit other crimes. They've admitted violations of the FISA law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. There's really no question about it. And finally, regarding undeniable, provable reality, we have the most unspeakable of all of these crimes, in my opinion, this reign of torture that has been carried out by this administration in our name. Now, clearly, we know that the government has tortured people in the past. Clearly, we know this, but it has never been the admitted policy of this country to torture. And it's a violation of the Geneva Conventions, and it's a violation of our own laws. And it's been a law for many, many years in this country, and they've deceived us about it, this torture, for many years. And the reason is that they can't possibly justify what they're doing. And what did they say? They say, well, we don't understand what it means. They have Dana Perino at a press conference saying to somebody who's asking about, well, how do you define torture? And she said, well, it's just so complicated. You have to read this long lawyer's memo. And she actually said, were you able to get through it? Well, That is completely at odds, not only with just common sense, and you don't even have to be a lawyer to understand it, but it's at odds with what this very administration is saying in a case that's going on in Florida right now. There's a prosecution of the son of Charles Taylor. And our own Department of Justice lawyers have been responding to the very same argument that the president's making about torture. Charles Taylor's lawyers are saying, oh, it's too vague. We don't know what it means. And what did our Department of Justice lawyers say? They say, very short, he's charged with specifically intending to inflict severe physical or mental pain. An ordinary person would know that the type of conduct described in detail in the indictment is prohibited. That's all they say about it. And the judge said, yeah, that's true. So that argument completely went down the tubes. So we know they've been doing these things for years. And the truth is, regarding impeachment, that you don't have to have provable specific crimes. We're talking about high crimes and misdemeanors. But it just so happens that we have both high crimes and misdemeanors and these provable statutory crimes. So in order for somebody to say, well, we just can't do anything about it because we can't get the votes, that is denying the reality of all these things. And we don't know whether it's going to succeed. And people ask me, you know, what do I do about this? And it is extremely discouraging. It's really beyond understanding that we continue to have to be fighting for what seems to be so simple and so true. But so I know I'm preaching to the choir, but to the extent it's useful, let me tell you what I like to say to other people. I like to talk about two women, and one of them is Molly Ivins. And what, yeah. And what she said is that if you're opposed to this war, if you want to hold this administration accountable, do something every single day. Just do something every single day. And then people say, well, what do I do? And I don't presume to have the answers, but I do know that the basic beginning of what we need to tell other people to do, because all of you are here, and it makes you feel better. There are people all around the country having meetings like this all the time. But if you look at the polls, the vast majority of people in this country believe that the war is illegal. The majority of people in this country think that there should be impeachment proceedings against Cheney, and about half the people think there should be impeachment proceedings against the president. So where are they? It's not enough just to answer a question on a poll. So what I would say to those people and what you might consider saying to them is it has to do with Louisa May Alcott. And she, of course, wrote Little Women and many other books, but she was also a longtime activist in the abolitionist movement, and she also was involved in the suffrage movement. And you can, I don't want to discourage you, but since she died in late 1880s, it took a long time, that cause. But in any case, she was asked about what she was doing in terms of the suffrage movement, and she said, if I can do no more, let my name stand among those who are willing to bear criticism and ridicule for the truth's sake, and then be able to rejoice in whatever measure of victory is won. And I would say to you that each time you get one more person to stand up along with you, that is a powerful victory. Thank you.
Former federal prosecutor Elizabeth de la Vega.
Our next speaker is Brian Kessler. And Brian joined the Marine Corps in 2002 after graduating from West Genesee High School in Camillus, New York. He served 4 years with the 2nd Battalion, 6th Marines, Fox Company as an infantryman. Brian has been deployed to Afghanistan once and Iraq twice. He has served in Babylon, Fallujah, and the United States Embassy in Kabul. After being discharged from active duty, Brian is currently pursuing an academic career in both Monroe Community College as well as the Rochester Institute of Technology when we're not asking him to do other things like speak at these events. I think he's supposed to be in class or something. I don't know. In 2007, Brian and Thomas Buonimo, who some of you know, formed the Iraq Veterans Against the War. T.J. Buonimo was the member of our group that got this started. And they have been very successful in forming the Rochester chapter of IVAW. So Brian currently acts as the chapter's treasurer. I just have to say that I have really had the pleasure of working with Brian quite a bit on some projects in Rochester, and I just always feel his warmth, his courage, and his sincerity. I really believe that Brian is a true winter soldier. So I'd like to welcome you, Brian.
Thank you. First, I'd like to thank Kathy, Declaration of Peace, and the church for hosting this event. I'd also like to say that whether you believe this war is legal or illegal, if it was decided to be a legal war, I would still be here right now. I'd like to also go off of what Scott Ritter said with the good fuel analogy, and I'm not here to decide for you, but I'm going to give you the good fuel that you need to make up your mind on this war. I think while I was in the military that the seed of doubt was planted on what we were doing, and I obviously didn't get any answers because I stayed in for all 4 years. Every time I looked to find out what our mission in Iraq was, the only thing I could find that was concrete was our mission as a Marine Corps rifle squad to locate, close with, destroy the enemy by fire and maneuver, or to repel the enemy's assault by fire and close combat. That's not what I joined the Marine Corps to do. Eventually, I was lucky enough to meet two commandants, which is the highest position you can hold in the Marine Corps. And when I asked them what we were doing, they would give me a long, drawn-out political response with no real answers. Other experiences that I think will come to a shock maybe to Scott Ritter is that I did see weapons of mass destruction, and we were in charge of them. If you know what the MOAB is, it's called the mother of all bombs. It's a bomb that is the largest explosive device created sub-nuclear ever, and we use this in Afghanistan. It creates a small mushroom cloud when used. Kathy had the honor of meeting Shalom Keller, who is one of our national coordinators for IVAW. And Shalom really put the fire under me when he exposed me to this amazing document called the Constitution. I had to say before I met Shalom that I never opened it up. I had signed my name away to defend it, but I had never opened it up. And one thing he pointed out was to defend against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And what you guys are all doing today is defending the domestic enemies that we all see around us. Those two commandants and the command I was involved with also suffer from the same fate that our president likes to think he does, and that's the perpetuation of lies. It's not good enough to say, oh, well, I was lied to, and I ordered my men to do this because I thought it was true at the time. When you're in charge of other people and their lives depend on you, you damn well better investigate what you're told. And there is a failure in our administration, our Senate, and our Congress to do just that.